on the WYSL stations is brought to you by Victor Chevrolet and Victor Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram.
And welcome to another edition of the Time Out Radio Show. It's episode number 201. Yeah, we're listening to some Ramsey Lewis doing the Beatles song, A Hard Day's Night. Sounds a lot like the other tune we have by Ramsey Lewis.
They are kind of similar. They have the adoring fan base.
Yeah, I like
chanting
that
along with them.
I like that a lot. I wonder if they were off the same album. Those songs.
A distinct possibility.
All right, so it's, yes, episode 201. I'm Nozzle.
Superstar.
And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Preston Pierce out of Canandaigua, and he's going to discuss cobblestone dwellings in the region, in the Western Finger Lakes region of New York State. Preston, are we going to stick in Ontario County? Is that your area of expertise, or?
Well, I know more about Ontario County, really, than any place else, but that stands to reason. I'm a native of Ontario County. I've been the Ontario County historian now for 40 years.
Okay, very good. You're not retired, then?
Well, it depends on what you mean by retired. I do have a teacher pension from some 33 years of teaching in the public schools of New York, but I teach part-time now at Finger Lakes Community College. And I still work for the Ontario County Department of Records and Archives.
That's great. Yeah, I know you do a lot of presentations around town, too. That's really excellent.
I do. That's one of the fun parts of the job.
Let me ask you something off the wall. Are young people interested in history? Like, you know, how do you find people that are really, really into it?
Well, I've never actually set out to find people who are really into it. I've never gone on a search for it, but they appear. Yeah. And it's been my experience that young people sometimes are more interested in history than they think they are. If you, for example, if I stand in front of a class of 18 to 20-year-olds and I would ask them how many of them like history, I might get one or two hands up. But then in the course of a conversation, if we start talking about things that they know and you give them a little bit of the backstory and how it developed and who the person was that the road's named for or why there's a historical marker in front of a house or why a monument in their hometown relates to some event in a textbook, then they start to get very interested. It has to be personal with them, and I think generalizing from that, that's one of the keys. It's why so many older people, it's certainly only one of the reasons, but why so many older people are interested in historical societies is you have to live long enough to start feeling that you yourself are a part of the historical continuum, and then you get interested.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Yeah, I remember you were on one time and you talked about lime kilns and why we have so many roads named Lime Kiln Road. That was fascinating. I like history.
That's directly related to the cobblestones, actually.
It's a good segue, right? What is a cobblestone? Like, you know, tell us the size, the type of rock we're talking about. You know, is it glacial detritus or what is it?
For the most part, they are. Some of the cobblestones are called lake washed. They're the ones that are most familiar to people. They're also the smaller ones. They can be anywhere from 4 to 10 centimeters in diameter, about the size of a medium to large baked potato. Then there are some larger ones that are rougher around the edge, but they're all generated by the glaciers. And, of course, the over four glaciation periods, there were very thick ice glaciers that extended down over the northern cap of the world and down across the Great Lakes and into what is now central New York. They gouged out the valleys, dammed up one end of them to create the Finger Lakes. They gouged out Irondequoit Bay, and they created the drumlins, the rounded hills that you find up around the lakes within 50, 60 miles of the south shore of Lake Ontario and other lakes. For the most part, the stones are limestone or sandstone or dolomite. They've been washed and kicked around for eons, and that's what's rounded out, especially the ones that are called lake washed.
So this, you kind of answered one of my other questions already, which is, were the stones transported from afar or sourced locally? In other words, as conveniently as possible. And it sounds like they were readily available.
They were.
So they had lemons, so they made lemonade, right?
Exactly. Yep. Okay. When the glaciers retreated, they retreated in a kind of fitful manner. So the glaciers would come down, then they would retreat a little bit, and then they would advance a little bit and retreat a little more and come back down a little more. And that tended to dump large quantities of glacial rubble and these stones in particular along the shores of the Great Lakes. So to build the houses, people had to go to where there were large quantities of these stones, and that was generally within 20 miles or so of the lakeshore. They'd fill up a wagon with them and haul them back down to wherever they were going to build a house. And that's one of the reasons why most of the cobblestone houses are in the tier of counties in New York that range on the west, primarily from Orleans County all the way past SOTUS to northern Cayuga County and that area on the east. There are houses below that. There are houses in Yates County, Ontario County, Livingston County. But those stones had to be carried there by the people that built the houses.
Were there any enterprising individuals who said, geez, there's a whole cache of stones here, so not only am I going to take enough carts to build a house, but I'm going to stockpile these things so that I can sell them to other people?
Don't know about that. I have to say I've never heard of anyone doing that.
Okay. Well, folks, that's just a teaser. We're going to get into more of that conversation after we do a tidbit. And today we've got Dan Erickson is going to talk about a chainsaw story. And then we're going to go sell some product and come back and talk to Preston Pierce, the historian for Ontario County. Don't touch that dial.
Here's the latest Time Out tidbit.
We got Dan Erickson of Leafs Sales and Service, located at 9328 County Road 14 in West Bloomfield.
Outside of Honey Eye Falls.
Okay, but your mailing address is Honey Eye Falls?
Honey Eye Falls, but okay, actually located in the beautiful town of West Bloomfield.
And phone is 585-624-4295.
That's correct.
See how that rolls off the tongue now? Because I've been listening to your ads. That's the purpose of advertising, right?
Oh, yeah, it sure is. It's worked very well. I get a lot of nice response from it.
Yeah, I understand somebody had a nice response to that and brought you two bucket loads of chainsaw parts.
2 5-gallon pails of two separate chainsaws. They were relatively the same model. One was an earlier version, one's a later version. I won't mention brands because I don't want to sound like I'm being petty or anything. But I work on anything. It doesn't matter. But they brought this saw in, and I guess it malfunctioned. They had a problem with it. And they said, can you put this back together and make one out of the two? And wow. I said, well, yeah, I can do that.
What made him think you could do that? Have you done this before for this customer?
Well, not for that customer, but I do. I'm not bragging, but I do have a reputation for working on hard cases.
The word is out there.
Yeah.
So it's like you're doing CSI, crime scene investigation.
Right. And the problem is that a lot of times when I get things like that is I always attribute it like disturbing the crime scene. Is that you're trying to figure out what happened. Well, it's the same thing with power equipment. If they worked on it, their brother worked on it, they already tore it apart, they're not maybe knowledgeable of knowing what they're doing. I don't know what's wrong with it either. exactly or what caused the problem in the first place. And what that entails is now I have to put it back together to a point to figure out what was wrong with it in the first place.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So from the customer's point of view, I would guess a lot of people are not forthcoming in telling you the complete history. I would think possibly you could say, well, I'm not going to tell the guy what really happened. I'm not going to tell my repairman exactly what happened because I want him to be objective and maybe he'll be able to figure it out. So is there anything wrong with that that theory? Should I be very transparent about
it? You have to be very transparent. It just makes my job so much easier is to let me know exactly what happened. I'm not going to judge people because things happen. Or things maybe happened that weren't, they caused it. It was just something failed in there. But yeah, it makes my job so much easier because it's time is money. And the quicker I can figure out something or quicker I can put something back together, the less money it's going to be involved and the cost of repairing it.
Okay, that's interesting. So were you able to get the 2 5-gallon buckets of parts to work as one unit?
I found the problem was it had a broken crank bearing. But when it was taken apart, it was completely taken apart. Like when they got the bag of parts at the factory and they put it together, it was an earlier version saw and a later version saw. And they made some changes, so I had to make sure that some parts that I was using from the later model, I had to include them to put them on the earlier model crankcase that he wanted to use. And I got it all back together, but I had to use another part saw that I had there as a sample to put it back together because a lot of these manufacturers, their information as far as assembly and disassembly and parts breakdowns and everything, some of them aren't the best and they are too generalized. What the information. So you have to figure out visually, and that's what still enters up back into when you disturb the crime scene. You've eliminated. I didn't take it apart, so now I have to figure out where these parts go back to put it back together. The saw did go back successfully. I got it to run. The guy was happy with it. It ran fine. I crossed my fingers when I started. but it just. It was satisfying that we were able to take two buckets of parts and make them into something that was functional.
I got another question. So what are the most common problems you see with chainsaws? I mean, are there any idiots out there that put the chain on backwards and
yes.
say, gee, it's just not cutting right? I don't mean to say idiots because I've done that. I figured it out at home. I got a blade resharpened or a chain resharpened, or they had a 2-for-1 sale going on. I put the chain on. I'm like, boy, my life is going to be so much easier. And it was actually worse. And it took me 5 minutes to figure out that there was the correct way and the backwards way to put it on. I mean, you could see making that mistake, right?
Well, I had a customer.
What else do you see?
Well, I had a customer with a chainsaw. That he brought it in one time, and he says, well, I was cutting with it, and it stopped cutting, so I turned the chain around and put it on the other way, and it didn't cut any better. I said, well, it won't cut on backwards. The technique with a chain, this is a little tidbit, is if you look at the chain, the teeth, the cutting edge is always going away from you as you look at the top of the bar, because actually what a chainsaw does, it cuts on the bottom part of the bar, and teeth are coming back towards you, the cutting edge, and that's what pulls the saw into the wood and makes it cut. If the saw ran in the opposite direction where the chain was on the other way, the saw would be constantly trying to push itself back towards you. So if you put a chain on, you look at the cutter edge on the top rail, you should always have the cutting edge running away from you or going out towards the tip of the bar.
Well, thanks a lot for that tidbit, Dan. We'll see you on the next one.
All right. Thank you.
And I know he does listen to the show. So, Dan, I got a question for you. Are you coming in tomorrow to record some more? We'll talk to you soon. So, we're going to bump out, sell some product, maybe some washing powder in a big orange box, and be back to talk with Preston Pierce about cobblestone dwellings. Notice I didn't say houses because there's more than just houses. Stick around. We'll be right back.
It's never too early to get ready for good weather and good times with your new ride from Victor Chevrolet. Now, lease a 2024 Chevy Trax 1 RS front-wheel drive. Just $219 a month for 24 months. Get the all-weather safety and capability of a 2024 Chevy Silverado LT Crew Cab for just $359 a month for 24 months. And then there's the 24 Chevy Equinox all-wheel drive LT. Only $249 a month for 27 months. $2,500 cash or trade equity. Tier 1 credit approval. Lessee responsible for repairs and maintenance. Must have lease and household for all these lease deals. Conditions apply. Get details at dealer. All factory rebates, incentives, and discounts apply. Whether you drive a Chevy or not, you can always trust your vehicle to our Chevy Certified Service Department. And check out our great used vehicle inventory, too. Come see how easy it is to do business with us. Together, let's drive at Victor Chevrolet, Route 96 in Victor.
Visit VictorChevrolet.com.
From Avon Feed and Supply, just in time for wet and winter weather, Dryshod waterproof footwear. There's a big selection of Dryshod for men and women. Its exclusive insulation breathes and keeps you warm without bulk, and you'll stay dry top to bottom with state-of-the-art waterproofing. While you're at Avon Feed, find everything for your pet, from feeding bowls to toys, leads, collars, beds, food, and treats. The Avon Feed and Supply Frequent Flyer Program feeds your feathered friends in the cold weather, and for every 10 bags you buy, you get one free. Avon Feed and Supply has what the big pet chain stores will never have. Tim Cole and his great, knowledgeable staff. And if you think you'll save money at that pet superstore, well, think again. While you're at Avon Feed, don't forget the two-legged pets with River Rat Thousand Island Cheese, Once Again Nut Butters, East Hill Creamery Products, Nunday Mustards, and Rickles Pickles. Open weekdays 9 to 6, Saturday 9 to 4. Avon Feed and Supply, West Main Street, at the bottom of the hill, just west of the Circle.
In 1926, the Avon Fire Department put an Aaron's Fox pumper into service. It now sits fully restored in a museum near Toronto. Avon has an opportunity to bring the Fox home for its 100th birthday for a fraction of its appraised value. The Aaron's Fox Full Circle Preservation Society needs your help. Look us up on Facebook or call 615-6463. Let's bring home the Fox.
All Seasons Wine and Spirits, your local and locally owned store, supporting your neighbors and our community. Always save at All Seasons on cases of your favorites. No sales events necessary. All Seasons Wines and Spirits, voted best in Livingston County, 255 Main Street in Avon.
Time Out Radio Show on the WYSL stations.
Trying to make it real compared to what...
Yeah, that's Les McCann on the piano and vocals, and that was Benny Bailey wailing on that trumpet solo. Love that. Anyways, we're talking with Preston Pierce today about cobblestone dwellings. And Mr. Pierce, who were the primary engineers, architects, and builders of these buildings? I think there's maybe an urban legend, maybe a misnomer, that it was people that had worked on the building the Erie Canal. Is there any truth to that?
There doesn't seem to be a great deal of it, no. It was conventional wisdom for a long time, but most all of the studies of cobblestone houses that are coming out now say that that was very likely not true, for a couple of reasons. First of all, because there was plenty of work for them to do building the canal and the expansion of the canal twice in the 19th century, especially during the time when these were built. Most of the cobblestone houses were built between 1824 and 1860. So that's the period when the Erie Canal is built, and then it's enlarged twice and the branch canals are built. Mostly today, the thinking is that the people who built the cobblestone houses were just sort of native stone makers, some of whom were better than others, kind of rose to the top. nobody in particular, no great architectural or construction firms like we might have today. It would take 2 to 3 years, actually, from the time they started bringing stones down from the lakeshore to put together a house. The stonemasons could lay up just 2 to 3 courses of stone in a day, and couldn't go any further because they had to wait for the cement, for the mortar to dry that's holding the stones together on the lower levels before they could add to it. And they had to mix the mortar, which is primarily from burning the limestone in those limestone kilns that were common throughout the area here.
Yeah, so talk about that a little bit. So you're burning stone, but what is burning? Is it the organic material, like, or what?
Well, yeah, it's not burning in the sense that you'd light a log on fire. It's subjecting it to great heat, which causes the chemical composition to change and for the stone to crumble. One of the reasons why cobblestone architecture became so big in upstate New York was that there were several things that were available in this location all at the same time. You had the cobblestones that had washed from the glaciers down across the lakes, deposited on the south shore. And then you had underneath the ground, spanning the entirety almost of upstate New York, these strata of limestone deposits. So there was a ready-made quantity there for quarries where they could cut the large squared-off chunks that were used for the corners and for the basement sills. And it also supplied limestone that could be subjected to heat and turned into the mortar that was used to keep the limestone, keep the cobbles together when the masons, the stonemasons, laid them up.
Question for you there, Preston. Is limestone still used for mortar?
You know, there's several different kinds. I believe that in some cases it is, yes.
Okay, because, you know, these, to me, and I'm not really, this is not an educated kind of comment, it's just a casual observation. There's a lot of these cobblestone houses that still exist. So I would say that they appear to have stood the test of time. So, you know, the construction methods they used were pretty darn good. And I'm wondering, you know, why did it die out? Was it a style? Was it a fad? Did they run out of cobblestones?
Well, we think of the cobblestone houses today as being very high-class antiques, a very neat thing, to put it in a colloquial term. But actually, the cobblestones were kind of a discount version. They were built out of materials you didn't have to buy. You could simply gather them. You might have to pay a little bit for somebody to work on the burning the limestone for the cement or quarrying some limestone, but you could largely put together a cobblestone house from materials that were available either free or at very low cost. You could use your family for free or inexpensive labor to gather the stones. And so the limestone or the cobblestone houses that we think of as being grand antique houses today were actually good houses, but cheap houses. And it was, going back to the canal, it was the success of the Erie Canal, and right on top of that, the success of the railroads that began to bring in the milled wood and the factory-made metal fittings and so forth that made the really fancy Victorian and early Victorian frame houses possible. And they were the ones that superseded the cobblestones. After 1860, there are virtually no cobblestone houses that are built. There are a few, but very, very few. At 1860 is considered the end of the cobblestone era.
Maybe this is another urban legend, but I wanted to check it out with you, Preston. I've seen or heard or read in various different sources that a really huge proportion of the cobblestone structures in this country are right here in this region.
Oh, they are. Yep. There are in upstate New York, there are a few more than 700 cobblestone structures, and that's considered to be a little better than 90% of all those that exist in the entire United States.
That's the number I heard, too.
Yeah, and in Wayne County has the greatest concentration of them. There are 210 in Wayne County. Ontario County has the second greatest concentration of them. We have 150 still standing. There are a few that have been demolished over the years or fell apart. The only way the cobblestone structures actually fall apart is through neglect. If they're just abandoned, they're no longer heated, there's no longer any preventive maintenance, eventually they will fall apart. And there are a few, a handful in each county where that has happened.
And no roof. Yep, that'll do it.
And the roof, right.
Can you talk about the historical significance today and the, you know, in quotation marks, the protection status of these buildings? Are they considered historically significant?
Oh, they are. They are. It's a significant architecture. The greatest protection they have, aside from local ordinances, it comes from the National Park Service's Register of National Historic Sites, and any cobblestone building just on the face of it is eligible for listing on the National Register.
I went to a presentation you gave at the Ontario County, where all the county buildings are. I forget what that complex is called, and you showed a slide about I don't know if it was a barn, but it was kind of sad. I don't know if you intended it to be that way, but it had been taken down or just out of disrepair, you know, torn right. down. And that's just darn sad, mm-hmm. I think. What building was that?
Well, there's a house in West Bloomfield. Part of it still stands. It's the woods have grown up, scrub woods have grown up all around it, and I think even in it. The last owners that occupied it just decided for some reason they didn't want to live there. And they moved just a little ways further out on the property and built a new home and just abandoned it. And it's just falling apart piece by piece over the years. There are others that were torn down because they were seen as being useless. There was a very large cobblestone structure that actually had four or five businesses in it out in the town of Farmington. That eventually was simply demolished because it got in the way of some new construction, and they didn't seem to find enough people that wanted to, you know, operate a blacksmith shop in there or a harness maker's shop or any of those other traditional vocations that people had.
I know you've got a whole presentation on this, but do you want to or can you talk about the decoration, like the columns, the porches, the cornice, and maybe even you see a lot of these cobblestone. You could look at it and see, oh, that's the original, you know, the square cobblestone right. bit, but then there's like a nice clapboard wood extension. Were those original or were those added on
well,
a lot later?
Well, some of those were added on okay. in the years that follow. The cobblestones are generally following four standard styles that were popular in the time they were built. The federal style, which is very boxy, and then the Greek revival, which tends to have an overhanging porch and often would have columns out front. A Gothic revival, which is a little fancier, generally without the columns. And then the Italianate, there aren't very many of those that tend to have the fancy cornices up around the corners of the roof and to have some cupolas up on top and that sort of thing. And the kinds of things that you're talking about could be added in later years. Sometimes the styles were changed. But generally, what was added to a cobblestone house depended on who built the house and when it was built.
On the way here on Heath Markham Road near the Gun Club, there's a nice cobblestone house. Now, if that guy or woman is listening, is there any funding available through the government to say you've got some major mortar issues that need to be resolved? Is there any money available for those people?
Not directly in terms of grants for cobblestones, but there are federal and state grants for the maintenance of historic buildings, depending on what they're used for. For example, there are a few cobblestone buildings that were also churches, and there's a special state program for historic churches, historic religious structures. There are also tax breaks. Much of the aid for historic buildings, barns is another area that qualifies for a lot of this, is in terms of tax abatements available to people who are maintaining or restoring historic structures. And as I said before, the cobblestone structures, just because they're cobblestone structures, are automatically assumed to be historical.
Next question. So did these dwellings have basements? Were they just dug out, or did they use a different type of stone, or did they use cobblestone basements? Or
they generally had a rubble basement. They would have sills, blocks of limestone around the edge of the dug basement that formed a sill, and it was on that sill, as they would do with brick houses. The house actually rests on the sills.
And so this is all not even necessarily steam power, but we're talking horsepower, right?
Right.
Yeah, wow. 1824 to 1860. Are there many examples? Well, I got another question for you. So what types of buildings were made? You made a point of saying that we had dwellings. We want to talk about dwellings, not homes. So there were privies, barns.
Right.
What else was built?
Well, there are several that turned into schoolhouses. In Ontario County, there are at least three that I'm aware of that became schoolhouses. There's one directly across the road from Eastview Mall. If any of your listeners are familiar with Eastview Mall.
No, it's a Starbucks.
Look, that's a farmhouse. But right catty-corner from that, still across from the mall, is a schoolhouse that was cobblestone.
Okay.
So there are some schools also in the town of Victor, down below Eastview Mall, around the hamlet of Fishers. There is a very interesting, it's a very plain building, but it's a
pump house.
For the railroad. It produced water for the early steam engines on what became the New York Central Railroad.
Yeah, so there's a little creek that runs through there. I always call it an unnamed tributary to Irondequoit Creek. And there's still a little bit of the infrastructure there for where the water was, siphoned off of that creek and made its way down and then under the tracks, which is now a hiking trail,
right,
to get to the pump house. And so remind the listeners, you're a railroad guy. Why did those trains need water?
Well, they were powered by steam, and steam requires water. It's the water that steam is nothing but water by a different category.
Was there a water car, or did the engine just get filled up with water?
They had a tender for the most part, and the tender carried fuel, wood early on, and then coal. And it also had a water tank.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Very good. See, I'm learning something here, folks. what else do you want to talk about? I have a couple of questions, but if you want to go in a different direction, you can go ahead. I found a website called cobblestonestructures.blogspot.com, and you can look and see all the buildings in Ontario County. I was wondering if a driving tour of some of these buildings could, in your mind, be easily compiled from this online resource?
It could be compiled from the resource. There's a group, I'll call it a statewide group, perhaps it's a national group, called the Cobblestone Society. Its headquarters is in Albion, out in Orleans County, and just above Albion is a hamlet of Childs, and at Childs there are three or four cobblestone structures that form a little sort of orientation museum for it. But the Cobblestone Society over the years has put together driving tours. I don't know that they've done any in recent years, but many of their driving tours that they started to put out in the 1960s and for, say, about 20 years after that are still available.
Yeah, we should give a shout-out to the Cobblestone Museum there in Childs. Really interesting. I don't know how many minutes do we have left there?
About 8 minutes. Oh. I was just going to say, I was aware there was a cobblestone map that somebody had put out some years ago.
There is a map for Ontario County.
Okay.
There were a couple of people back in the 1970s who were very interested in the cobblestones, and they went all around the county. They inventoried the entire county for cobblestones. They even documented the existence of some that by that time had been demolished. They placed them on a county highway map. And so you can, it was a supplement to a book. Actually, I have a copy of the book with me, Ontario County Cobblestones, little fold over.
Oh, yeah.
They're a little bit hard to get these days, but it lists town by town in the 16 towns of the county, all of the cobblestone structures and exactly where they are, and there's a map at the back of that. There are some others that are worth having. One of the newer books is called Cobblestone Quest, Road Tours of New York's Historic Buildings. Rich and Sue Freeman are the authors of it, and it compiles a lot of information beyond Ontario County. And then the classic, covering the entire area, a lot of public libraries should have this and historical societies. It's called Cobblestone Landmarks of New York State. And that doesn't purport to cover every cobblestone structure in the state, but it gives you an idea of the wide variety there are and the different types of architecture associated with them, some round, some octagonal, mostly rectangular. Privies, barns, shop blocks, like the one I mentioned in Farmington. And this is Gerda Petterich, P-E-T-E-R-I-C-H, is the photographer for it. And then Olaf Schellgren Jr., Carrie Latton, and Robert Frasch were the compilers of this Cobblestone Landmarks of New York State. And it was put together in 1978, but widely available.
Well, that's a great resource there you brought in today.
Just checking, Cobblestone Quest is available on Amazon. So.
Nice. So where do you want to go next, Preston? You got anything else you want to talk about? I'm looking at my questions. I think I've got through them all. You mentioned, do we know where the oldest cobblestone building in this area is?
There are some, I don't know that anybody knows the oldest, absolutely, but you mentioned the one up across from Eastview Mall that's now a Starbucks. That's one of the oldest.
And you said that's a farmhouse.
Yeah, it was. And it's one of the interesting things about that is that it's really well documented. That's one of the few cobblestone buildings that we know who built it, because the person who built it died shortly after they built it, and in the settlement of their estate, the person's widow had to submit a bill to the owner of the house asking, you know, reminding them that they still owed money to what was then the estate of the former builder, and that they should, you know, submit that money to the estate to clear the debt.
Yeah, I just thought of another advantage, which you kind of touched on earlier about building a cobblestone house, is you generally don't have a mortgage at the end of it, right? You build it, and it's kind of done.
You generally owned the property that it was built on, and you gathered the material, as I say, using free or cheap labor, family, friends, neighbors. And then you got some local person that had to be paid for doing the masonry work to put it together. But it was an inexpensive way of using the material that was right there to build a very substantial home.
Anything else there, Superstar?
No, I don't know. I mean, I had heard repeatedly that some of the cobblestones that were used, you look at the chronology of when the Erie Canal was being built from about 1817 until, the late 30s, and the proximity to the canal route to some of the locations of some of these houses, I just read in several different sources that the leftover material from the excavation of the canal freed up a lot of these cobblestones. Maybe that's not the case.
Well, that could be true. Although you've got to remember that the canal was being dug, whereas most of the cobblestones were laying on the surface.
Is that right? You didn't have to dig them out, huh?
They were laying around in fields that had to be cleared of the stones.
Right. So the cobblestones were a nuisance to farming.
Right.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent. Well, we're talking to Preston Pierce, who is a part-time instructor at FLCC.
Correct.
And how many days a week does your class meet?
Three. Monday, days. Wednesday, and Friday.
Wow.
I got a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What about the cobblestone foundations? Now, I know that there are a lot of homes that are not, completely cobblestone. Maybe they're frame in construction. They may be brick, but you see cobblestone foundations.
The real foundation on which the cobblestones rested were sills, mostly limestone sills. But in terms of foundations, a lot of that is what they called rubble or fieldstone.
Oh, okay.
Not actually cobblestone. That may sound like a distinction without a difference, but
But you mentioned earlier in the program, cobblestones have there's a certain dimension.
Right.
Not everybody qualifies to be a cobblestone, folks.
Right.
You got to have the right credentials. So,
right.
Like about the size of a baked potato, you said.
Right. Medium to a large baked potato, or say your fist to double the size of your fist.
Right. I've seen some structures that had really quite small cobblestones.
Right.
Interesting. And all just lying around on top of the surface. Well, Naz, got anything else?
Yeah, yes, I do. Do we have, are we out of time or what?
A couple more minutes.
Do we know if there are a lot of examples of, say, where the privy, the original privy still exists, but the house was taken down and a more modern house was, put in its place? Perhaps?
I'm thinking over in the town of Gorham, there may be one. There's a cobblestone privy connected to that or connected with that schoolhouse that's across the street from Eastview Mall.
Okay.
There's a cobblestone privy over there.
Nice. Very nice. Well, thanks a lot for coming in, for taking the time. We know you're a little bit under the weather. But
Thanks for toughing it through here, Preston.
And we'll hopefully have you back at another point.
Anybody's interested in any more information about cobblestones, this is just a resource list, absolutely free. If anybody wanted to write to me, contact me as the Ontario County Historian, I'd be happy to send them one.
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks a lot.
She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving, 'cause I've left that girl so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. But she'll just hear that phone keep on ringing.
Celebrate spring with savings and selection of the all-new Victor Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram at 6484 Route 96 in Victor. Check these values. A 23 Chrysler Pacifica Hybrid Touring Minivan in brilliant black crystal pearl coat is only $459 a month for 39 months. And a 24 Jeep Wrangler Willys 4XE in bikini clear coat is only $319 a month for 36 months. Lease deals require $2,500 cash or trade. First payment, DMV, taxes, and fees due at signing. Other conditions may apply. See dealer for details. Shop 23 Jeep Gladiator Crew Cab Pickups, up to 20% below MSRP, 7 to choose from. They've also got 23 Jeep Grand Cherokee 4XE SUVs, up to 25% off MSRP, 7 to choose from. We welcome Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram customers in Victor, Canandaigua, Macedon, Fairport, and Finger Lakes. Shop Victor Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram now at 6484 Route 96, just east of Victor.
Debunking advertising from the Law Office of Christopher Johnson. One ad some injury attorneys inundate you with, what's your case worth? Call us and find out. You know, nobody can tell you, quote, what your case is worth over the phone. Nobody knows. The ultimate answer to, quote, what your case is worth involves weeks or months of research, evaluation, and preparation. Many factors go into any compensation you might get, like applicable law, who's actually at fault, how much insurance coverage there is, and many, many other factors. At the Law Office of Christopher Johnson, the singular focus is getting your life back on track after an accident or injury. That takes money, and it helps when the advice and legal advice you get has a one-on-one focus informed by straight talk. Christopher Johnson Attorney, car, truck, motorcycle accidents, personal injury, and DWI defense. Call 585-415-3803. 585-415-3803.
Tom Walls team member, Emily.
We don't want you to stop in for a Tom Walls Haddock dinner. We want you to stop in every week for a Haddock dinner and bring your family. We like hearing your family laughing and enjoying themselves. They bring joy to our restaurant. Crispy golden haddock, hot crispy fries, and just made coleslaw. That's what we bring to the table. Now you make it a family tradition. Tom Walls. Good, good.
Share the good times. Tom Walls.
Time Out Radio Show on the WYSL stations.
I don't care what they say. Anytime you are in a bad mood, you just hum this song and you feel infinitely better, I find.
And this song is?
This is the Banana Splits TV show theme song, which I believe, this could be incorrect, was written by the same guy who wrote Pretty Flamingo, which is kind of a nice tune.
Oh, wow.
It was covered by Manfred Mann and Rod Stewart and a whole bunch of other people. Multi-talented guy, I guess. A lot of fun. So what time you got over there now, Superstar?
It's another WYSL timeout. Compare-o-scope.
And that's a side-by-side comparison of an original or early song recording and a popular cover of the same song. Today we're featuring It's Going to Take Some Time. I have it written here as It's Going to Take Some Time. We were looking it up, and it's spelled It's Gonna Take Some Time. The writer was Carole King, and it was written by Carole and Tony Stern for King's 1971 album Music. This is, Carole King Klein, born Carole Joan Klein, February 9th, 1942, is an American singer-songwriter, musician who has been active, get this, since 1958. One of the most successful female songwriters of the latter half of the 20th century in the U.S., she wrote or co-wrote 118 pop hits on the Billboard Hot 100. This is her original of It's Gonna Take Some Time.
It's gonna take some time this time to get myself in shape. I really fell out of line this time. I really missed the gate. The birds on the telephone line
next time
are crying out to me
next time,
and I won't be so blind next time. I'll find some harmony.
but it's going to take some time this time, and I can't make demands. But like the young trees in the winter time, I learn how to bend. After all the tears we've spent, how could we make amends? So it's one more round for experience, and I'm on the road again, and it's gonna take some time.
Almost sounds like a television theme song in some way, shape, or form.
It kind of does, yeah, her version.
It's going to be tough to top that. The cover today is The Carpenters from 1972, and they were an American vocal and instrumental duo consisting of siblings Karen, who lived from 1950 to 1983, and Richard, born 1946. They produced a distinct soft music style, some might say sappy, combining Karen's contralto vocals, which is, I guess, means the lowest female register of a singer. Contralto, that is, with Richard's harmonizing, arranging, and composition skills. During their 14-year career, the Carpenters recorded 10 albums, along with numerous singles and several television specials. Let's listen to it.
It's gonna take some time this time to get myself in shape. I really fell out of line this time. I really missed the gate. The birds on the telephone lines are crying out to me.
Next time.
And I won't be so blind next time. And I'll find some heart.
But it's going to take some time this time,
and I can't make demands. But like the young trees in the winter time, I'll learn how to bend. After all the tears we spent, how could we make amends? So it's one more round for experience, and I'm all
very nice. So, Dr. Preston Pierce, I know you're into history, maybe hopefully a little music history. Are you familiar with either of those? And let's ask you this. Which version did you prefer or not, and maybe some insight as to why?
Well, I think I would have to say that I like the Carpenters version. It's a little more upbeat, the instrumentation of it. Just more appealing to me. And I also have to say that I'm of the age where I remember the Mickey Mouse Club, and Karen Carpenter was a Mouseketeer.
Was she really?
Yeah. I did not know cool. that.
Did not know that. Awesome. Very good. Superstar, which one did you prefer?
Carpenters. Kudos to Carole King for co-writing it. And she did her usual signature great sound, but the arrangement of the Carpenters version is great, and I just think that Karen Carpenter had one of the most beautiful voices in the pop era.
Yeah, it's going to be unanimous this week. I'm going to go with you guys, Carpenters. I think it flows better. Like Preston said, it's a little more upbeat. And, you know, I love Carole King and her version, but I'm going to hand it to the Carpenters this week.
Yeah, so the background vocal harmonies are beautiful.
Yeah, they sure had a style or something. It was really great. As time has gone on, I've learned to appreciate them a lot more. And even though this isn't Dickie Betts, this is Allman Brothers, this is the piano solo. We should have probably chosen the guitar solo. Dickie Betts passed away last week, I believe. That's show number 201. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
Time Out on the WYSL stations is brought to you by Victor Chevrolet and Victor Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram.